session number 24570, Reel 2.
Piers Plowright, Reel 2. We got to the point where you were called up, and you were called to go to the Tower of London on the 4th of October 1956. Now, what happened when you went? Could you sort of take us through what happened?
Well, first of all, I should say that I was extraordinarily innocent in every way about army life, about the world apart from the middle-class world that I'd seen, about the rough side of life and the rough side of London. And I very well remember appearing. I was nervous, very nervous, but I think if I'd known what was coming, I'd have been even more nervous. Arriving at the gate, the main gate to the Tower of London, there was a sergeant there with a clipboard, and he took my name and details. And I remember noticing his hands, which were, although he was clean, because he was a sergeant after all, they were sort of deep stained, and it wasn't just nicotine. I suspect it was Duraglit and Blanco and firing guns. I just think he was 30-something, had seen military service, I'm sure, active service. And he was curt, but not offensive. But I was still wearing civvies, of course. And then you go through this process. I can't remember in what order, but you get your hair cut, and that's a brutal cut, no question about style. And you get issued with your kit.
Hang on, with the haircut, what was your hair like before you
longish.
Went in?
Longish. I was aesthetic. My mother didn't mind, but my uncle, who was very blimpish, used to say every Christmas when we had the family party, get the boy's haircut, because I thought it was, I liked it, you know, quite to the collar. Nothing like, not hippie. So that went off, and it was pudding base and straight, short back and sides, and a bit of mop left on the top. And I remember looking in the little mirror in the barrack room. We each had an iron, a sort of steel locker, green, and a little mirror inside. And I saw this awful creature with sticking out ears, because my ears are quite big, and all my pride vanished. And then the shapeless uniform that you got, we had a...
Now tell me about the kitty now.
Yes, well, the kitty, we went to a store where a quartermaster bung stuff at us, and it seemed to all be very speedy. There was no measuring up or anything. And all I remember was we had a battle dress, battle dress material, very uncomfortable and itchy, roughly to our size. Belt, boots, webbing, what the hell were they called? Things you put on your ankles.
Puttees.
Puttees. Sort of puttees. You didn't wind them round. They had little buckles. Yeah, I think we just call them, I don't know what we call, anklets, perhaps. They were to be blancoed, greenish. Lots of brass to go on the belts. The boots, of course, with laces. A great coat, and you had to sew on your own buttons. A berry. The Fusilier's badge, which I can't quite remember now, but I have a feeling was a pineapple, with a little white cockade. Now, the white cockade was terribly proudly guarded by the Fusiliers. They may have done away with it. And it had to be made to blossom by putting it in an empty Duraglit tin and lighting a match underneath. I think I've got this right, so that it went sort of, it puffed up. And if it didn't puff or looked wilted, you were in big trouble. You had a shabby, what I call sort of day wear things, like trousers and jacket, and they were made of a sort of highly washable, not exactly denim, but lighter material. And that was what you wore most of the time. And so you got straight away into those things. Underwear, I think, was army as well, and I think it was green. I think it was a green vest and green tie-up pants. Don't think it was elastic. I can't quite remember that. And army socks. And your barrack room was your home.
Tell me about... Were you actually in the Tower of London?
Yes, yes. We went to the store, and then I may have got the order wrong, we had to run up some stairs and shout out our religion. Name, date of birth, and religion to a corporal at a table. And I actually was Anglican, but if you weren't, if you said nothing, the sergeant said, you can't be fucking nothing, Church of England. So that went down in the book. And then having done all that, you went to your barroom, and at that stage, it was the Lance Corporal who took over, and he was always a bullying character. I mean, that was his job. His job was to break your spirit, in a sense, to coordinate you before the sergeant got to work on you, to break you down, and... There you were, and taken to your barrack room, a bed, a locker. And then my eyes and ears were open, because I think there was one other public school boy there, but otherwise everybody else was East End London. I got to like them very much, but the shock of the language, you know, I know this sounds terribly, terribly prissy, but I hadn't heard such things. At a public school, we'd had bollocks and shit and you know, a few things. But the F word, the C word, the B word, hardly. And continuously, relentlessly, in every sentence, all the time. I couldn't believe my ears. So that was a bit of a sort of bombardment.
Did you start picking it up yourself?
No. Well, again, you see, this awful priggish side to me. I thought, I'm bloody well, or I didn't, I'm not going to, I'm buggered if I'm going to do this. So I didn't. And throughout my army career, I didn't actually go in for it. The other thing that was an interesting cultural clash was that I had been taught to say prayers and kneel down at my bed. So I did. I remember thinking, looking around the room of about 16 others, do I do this? I did, and slippers were chucked at me, and a bit of joshing, but actually no violence, and in the end, nobody took any notice. So I sort of won that one. Became a bit of a defiant thing after a bit. The guys in the room, as I say, East End Cockney, no formal very little formal education. Some had come straight from school, some had been away from school probably since, what would it have been, 14? They'd been working in the markets or in shops or whatever beforehand. Nice guys. We sort of got on, but there wasn't much time. The thing that's amazing about the first 6 weeks of army life, or used to be, there's no time. Everything's at the double.
Now, let's have a bit more about the barrack group. Can you describe the barrack?
Yeah, we were in the block. I think it was known as the Wellington Barracks, immediately opposite the White Tower, across that big square, which was our parade ground. From the window, I could look over the wall towards Tower Hill Station, longingly at the real world and free people, because there was no leave at all for the first month. So I could look out at London, but couldn't get there. The barrack room was Victorian, kind of ogival windows, thick glass. It smelt not so much of sweat as of polish and all those army smells. It was quite clean, because you had, that was another thing, scrubbing out and cleaning. And I remember one of my first jobs was in the kind of landing outside the barrack room. Stone stairs, iron banisters, rooms for about 12 to 14 people, iron beds, and of course the way you laid out your bed and the daily inspection. Everything had to be so-so. Hospital corners, I'd never learnt that. Sheets, kit.
Well, let's go, as you started, let's have a look at how would you prepare your kit for
Well,
for
every morning there was an inspection. I remember, well, first of all, getting up. The waking up, and this was right through training, was horrible. It was a bloke, a corporal or lance corporal with a broom, who thundered on the door and then the bottom of each individual bedstead. Get up, you lout! You know, I won't go in for the language, but it was fairly violent. So there was no sort of gentle waking, not even a school bell. And that would have been at six. Then there was quick wash and scrub. Then there were chores, clean the latrines, scrub round the outside of the landings and things, and that was one little side thing. The corporal said to me, whitewash the landing. And I was meant to whitewash the border, but I whitewashed the middle, so people got stuck to it. I was, you know, that's sort of how stupid I was, how unpractical, things like that. But then we had to start laying out our kit for inspection before breakfast. Now that was making the bed immaculately with hospital corners, green blankets. The pillow end, you put your kit, which was regulated with the boots on a ground sheet in front, beautifully polished and shining, no dust in the welts. And we used, to polish the boots, we used empty tins of boot polish, or the lids, into which we put a little polish, and then we lit the polish some way with a match. So we got a liquid thing, and then you rubbed it in. Of course, with the new boot, this took ages, and spat, and rubbed, and spat, until you got a mirror shine. And you did that on all the really shiny bits, and the welts and the top bits, of course, had to be brushed beautifully, and then not made to shine, but absolutely made clean and polished underneath. And the undersides of the boots, if there was any sort of brass or studding on it, that had to be polished up. All the brass of the belts and the pouches and the other bits, brilliant shine. So you made this little pile, boots in front, clothes, battle dress, beautifully pressed, great coat, buttons shone, and on top the hat, the berry, and on top of that the hackle, that's what the plume was called, and the badge blossomed out, the badge shining, and the guy would come round. The officer often came, if not the sergeant, and anything wrong, the officer or sergeant would take their pace stick and toss the whole lot on the floor. And you would probably have to not only do it again, but come for special inspection at some other time. And worse than that, if you really offended by a really lousy turnout or kit, you could be put CB, confined to barracks, and made to report to the guard room every hour or so, and doubling here and there and carrying a rifle over your heads. I mean, it was exhausting, and I was not physically, wasn't that I wasn't robust, I was simply untrained.
How did you find this sort of bull of...
Well, I thought it was madness, and I thought it was horrible. And I remember hating the only other public school boy there who'd been to Oxford and was brilliant. But he was bloody brilliant at everything. He got the best kit, you know. Private Smart, Smart's the name and Smart's the appearance, the sergeant used to say. And, oh, you horrid, you know, you horrible character. Because I couldn't do it, you know. My buttons fell off, my boots didn't look good. There was a lovely camaraderie, so I wasn't bad at boots, and I used to help some guys with boots, and they'd help me with their buttons, with my buttons. So there was a sort of beginning of a team spirit that grew up, which I liked.
Did you resent having to do it in the fact that, did you think it was a waste of time?
No, I didn't think that. I just thought it was humiliating, and I longed in a pathetic, childish way for my mum. You know, I just wanted to be home where it was comfortable, and people didn't shout at you, and you had leisure, and people thought you were intelligent. Because, you know, I remember that for a classic remark, you know, what the fuck have you been doing? And I said, well, I thought, Sergeant, he stopped me there. You are not paid to think in the army, you know, and that sort of thing. And I couldn't understand it. I thought it was very brutal. I revised my opinion with hindsight, which we'll come to. The parade ground was the centre of our activities, mostly drilling and bull in those early days.
We might as well carry on through the day. I think
all right.
The best way.
Well, then there was a meal, and it was...
Now, what was army food like, perhaps compared to your public school?
It wasn't... Much worse. It wasn't wonderful, but you were hungry. It was cooks standing behind a big tureens of stuff. No choice. And the great thing was to get your plate at the right height when they shoved the stuff on it, because if you were too high, they broke the plate, and if you were too low, they missed the plate. So it was just the right, and that was it. You know, you didn't get a second chance. So you ate the food gratefully, but I remember it as being slightly foul-smelling chunks of meat and veg, and lots of gravy, hot, maybe soup, chunks of bread of some kind. And then you sat in this, it was a sort of large canteen, I suppose. I don't remember a naffy in the tower. Naffies became great places of pleasure later. But we all sat there and scoffed away. There wasn't much time, probably half an hour for a meal.
Was there enough?
Yes, they never felt hungry. They had this farce of the officer or all the officer came around, any complaints? But you bloody well didn't dare to have any. Were two wise, few wise guys who did, and they sometimes got into trouble, you know. So then your meals were scurried through: breakfast, lunch, tea we had, and a supper. And in between, it was drill, drill, drill.
Now tell me about drill, because you'd done drill.
Yes.
But you'd had a bit of trouble with it.
I got much better. Something clicked on the barrack square in the Tower of London, which was to do with everybody doing the same thing at the same time. I got a certain pleasure out of that. We had a very big sergeant. I can't remember his name. He had a moustache. He was sort of huge voice. He was the classic sergeant major. And I remember thinking, when I get out and I'm, you know, I've got status, I'm going to come back and tear this guy to shreds. Of course, I never did. But he tore us to shreds then. It was shout, shout, run, run. But he got us going, and I did begin to like the sound of feet coming together and the feeling of a rifle onto the shoulder and presenting arms. All that, in a funny, strange way, became satisfying, and I got better. Not bad at all at drill. Not any idea about a rifle and how it worked, and all that actually didn't seem to happen very much in the first 6 weeks. I may be wrong about that. Don't remember going to ranges. That came later when I moved to Canterbury, which is the next stage.
What about PT or physical training generally?
I don't remember doing much. The drill seemed to be it. We must have done some physical training, but it's been blanked out, and thereby hangs a tale a bit later on. Drill, food, swearing, preparing kit, inspections, being torn off a strip, just surviving. I began to learn the great army dictum: if you carry a broom, you'll get away with things. You know, look as if you're doing something, going somewhere. Or with bits of paper. There were lots of chits, and everything had to be treble signed, you know. You couldn't draw anything without lots of chits, and you know, the army thing of everything being backwards, brooms for military for the use of type, things like that, yes.
What about, tell me a bit more about your relationship with the Lance Corporal and the Sergeant. I mean, cause
well, we didn't have any much, it was a shouting relationship. I never got close to them. It was Private Plowright. I was Private Plowright, 2334-5364, Army number, doesn't go away, does it? Pay parade, every Friday. Something ridiculous like 2 and 3p, I can't remember what it was, and you had to be all drawn up, the whole squad. I suppose there were about, because the intake was about 50 people, something like that. Raw recruits. You'd be drawn up and you'd do alphabetical order, shout out your name and number, and you then had to march forward, come to attention in front of the table where the officer and the sergeant sat, salute, put your pay book forward, shout out your name and number again, get your pay, salute, step back a pace, turn round, stamp your feet, march back into your place. And that was always true of pay parade, even when I got into a civilian clothes wearing thing in Malaya, you still did the pay parade as a military thing.
Anything else about that period? I well, know it's only 6 weeks. That would be from October through into
Christmas, more or less. Is that about right? Just before Christmas.
Yeah, November, late November.
Yeah, that's right. Two or three nice things. I did quite the history and drama of the Tower did kind of steal over. It's extraordinary being in the Tower of London at night, the silence and the yeomen. And hearing the key ceremony sort of distantly, and the odd visiting dignitary. And the people, of course, tourists were coming in. They're roped off from us. And then the wonderful first leave. When I said a month, it might have been 3 weeks or something. I was allowed 24-hour pass to go home in uniform. And I felt a bit proud, actually, in a strange kind of way, you know, how quickly you learn to show off and wearing the uniform on the tube. And I think we had a pass. I don't think I had to pay. Going home and then being cosseted and wearing my own pyjamas, you know, that kind of thing. It was fantastic. Then it was a 36-hour pass, and I may have had 148, I think, whole weekend. Then coming back was pretty painful. The other blokes, I can't remember any of them by name. We got quite chatty, but my relationships with other soldiers got deeper later because I lived longer with them and so on. So that was it, and then one thing that developed was, of course, where were we all going to go? We'd all joined the Fusiliers, but we weren't all going to be Fusiliers. And I remember doing an intelligence test in which I scored very, very low. It was all, you know, cubes and boxes and what goes with what, and I haven't that sort of mind. And I remember the quite kindly sergeant saying after that, he said, you haven't scored very high. He said, there's the catering corps, but you're probably officer material, so... I think we'll send you down to Canterbury for the, what was it called, the officer selection training, something like that, OST, I've got the initials slightly wrong, and for that we're sending you to Canterbury, and that was the next stage, and that was just before Christmas 1956.
Where exactly were you going in Canterbury? Was it into the barracks? Or
yes, it was the Weems Barracks, I think. Weems. It was called Weems, W-E-M-Y-S-S. There's an Earl of Weems, and is there a battle? I don't know. Now, that was a very extraordinary barracks on the outskirts of Canterbury, and I remember going by train in uniform. Two or three or four Fusiliers went, because what happened there was people from all over the new intakes who were thought to be of officer material. Now, that was mainly to do with class. Mainly, did you speak well? Had you been to a public school? But there were a few exceptions, people I obviously thought had leadership qualities. So people from King's Dragoon Guards, Highland Light Infantry, Sappers, I can't remember, but lots of different regiments came together into a squad at Canterbury at the Weems Barracks, which was, as I say, a very odd building because there'd been a muddle in the plans and the barracks that was meant to be built in India was built in Canterbury and vice versa. So it was open verandas and, you know, sun areas and so on in the middle of winter. But I immediately noticed a certain, not slackness, but a certain relaxation, I think, because we were potential officers. We were called POs, actually, potential officers. We were still drilled, we were still shouted at, we were still rigid discipline, still woken up with rooms in the early hours of the morning, and we were still rushed about, but it was just a little bit more on equal terms. And we did things, we had to give these famous lecturettes that all national servicemen did on any subject we like, and I gave one on modern art. You know, they had to be 5-minute talks to show that we had the gift of holding people's attention. We went to rifle ranges, we did grenade throwing.
Tell me a bit more about the sort of weapons training in yes. more detail, as you remember.
Yes, as I remember. Well, first of all, it was the rifle. The ordinary, you know, pull back the bolt to what sort of rifle it was. And the rifle, of course, was your more than your friend. It was your talisman. And if you lost a bit of it or didn't clean it, that was you lost a bit of it, that was into jug, you know, that was the prison. Not prison, but, you know, back confined to barracks and maybe imprisoned in the guardroom. If you didn't clean it properly, that was a punishment thing that you had to do so many days extra drill and rushing about and bring the rifle for inspection every few hours. So there was the cleaning of the rifle, there were the parts of the rifle, there was knowing what the parts were, then there was filling with blanks, and there was learning to fire on a range somewhere like Shorncliffe or somewhere. Anyway, outside Canterbury.
How did you take to actually firing?
Terrible, awful shot. I couldn't see what I was meant to be looking at. It wasn't that I had bad eyes or anything, I just didn't get the hang of it. So I used to miss the target. I remember hitting it once, and the sergeant said, good shooter, the officer, good shooting, Plowright, but I'd actually been adjusting my strap at the time. I hadn't been looking. So it was a complete fluke. Now we come to bayonet drill before we get to the Bren gun, because, of course, this, if you know your famous play by Willis Hall, The Long and the Short and the Tall, that's the moment when the army stops being funny, because you're given a bayonet, you fix it, it's a real bayonet, and you charge a straw dummy. And the corporal says, and I want you to scream blue murder and stick him in the guts. And so you had to scream, partly to get over your fear, and dash at this straw dummy and stick and withdraw and stick and withdraw and then form up the other side. And, of course, for some people that was a terrible moment. I remember taking it as a piece of theatre, really. Didn't think of the reality. But it was a defining moment. Just as a moment on the parade ground was, we had a little sergeant called Sergeant Morrish. Tiny man, looked like a little turkey. I grew very fond of him because he was very sweet and not a great disciplinarian. He's the sort of man, if he'd been a teacher, the class would have been totally out of control in 5 minutes, because he didn't look dignified and his uniform wasn't that fitting, you know. But I remember him one morning trying to drill us, and we were all over the place, and he stopped us and he said, there's bloody Hungarians dying in the street and you can't get your effing drill right. And he was almost weeping. And the real world came in there, that there could be a war that we might be involved in. Forgotten about that. That was Hungary. Was that November 56?
So it
sounds if I went slightly earlier to Canterbury than I said. Could have got the timing a bit wrong there. But when the Hungarian revolt broke out, I was already in Canterbury. Sergeant Morrish, I mean, I tell you endless tales about him, because he was just such... He had this thing which a lot of sergeants have, sort of memorable, silly phrases. Like, he would look at a pair of boots and he'd say, your boots is sadly lacking for want of bloody blacking. Which is not great poetry, but it sort of stuck with me 50 years on, you know, or nearly 50 years on. I just loved... There was a great deal of humour in the army, which was sometimes conscious and sometimes unconscious. The conscious one was the jokes. The unconscious one was the absurdity, almost zen. Zen. I made a programme about this at the BBC, that the army is actually quite zen in many ways. It's illogical. It's crazy. You know, the famous Goon Show remark like, silence when you speak to an officer. But, I mean, you'd heard things like that, you see. People didn't sort of think how absurd it was. But then it made you think maybe speech can be silent. So there was a kind of theological, existential, zen side to the army, which I appreciated and appreciate to this day.
You didn't kick against it then?
No, I'm a conformist by nature. I hated a lot of it, but I got to work with it, survive it, skive a lot. You learn how to skive. I mean, for instance, I used to do guard duty, which was very boring because, I mean, nobody ever did anything. The IRA hadn't got going. But you were meant to march around this gloomy barracks at night carrying a club for hours and hours in the freezing cold. And I used to nip into the bathhouse. Dreadful if I'd been caught. Take off my clothes, have a lovely hot bath, and then resume my march. You know, so half the guard duty went in a hot bath. Now that was very, very punishable offence. Very skivy. But it was... You sort of got into that temperament a bit. In the same way that freedom became extraordinarily valuable, because if you're repressed and chased all day, when you're off in the evenings, you never feel so free again in your life. It wasn't that you weren't completely off duty. The military police caught you eating fish and chips, for example, in uniform. You were clapped in jug. But eventually we were allowed to go out in civilian clothes, and I remember the release as you got through the guardroom and you had 2 or 3 hours to go to the cinema, eat fish and chips. Girls I wasn't really into in those days. I remember the Red Dean invited me to tea once, the famous Dr. Hewlett Johnson, because he was a communist and a Christian.
What do you remember of that?
Oh, I was wandering about in battle dress around the cathedral, and he said, "Oh, young man, come to tea tomorrow." He was very eccentric, and I went, and he had 3 daughters and a wife, and we got, you know, we had lovely tea and cakes, and I can't remember what we talked about. We sat in this beautiful room with clocks and pictures and photographs of previous deans. He was just eccentric. He's a bit like Lord Longford, you know, sort of endlessly kind, a bit scatty, not very worldly. And he got into big trouble later because of his politics. He probably thought, not that he could preach revolt, but that he could help a poor ordinary soldier escape from the tyranny of militarism for a bit. So that was sort of day out. Yeah, just going back to weapon training, 2 things I particularly remember, the Bren gun, which I was terrified of because it was automatic and could one control it, and it would leap out of your hands and seem terrifyingly dangerous. And
tell me about the Bren gun training.
Well, all I remember was it was all done by numbers and very fast. So you'd have your magazine on the floor, you'd have to load magazine, which you did, shoved it in the gun. Then I can't remember the exact order here, but you had to lie flat, mount, I mean take the gun to your shoulder. This was on the range. All the orders have now gone from you. Sights, something like that. Fixed target, fire. And then... I mean, very frightening to one not skilled with weapons. And there was the terrible thing that, you know, the bolt might chop your hand off. I mean, if you weren't careful, that could happen with a rapid bolt maneuvering. So again, terrible shot. The Bren was one worse than the rifle because you felt it was out of control. And the worst of all was grenades. Because for some reason, I couldn't bowl in cricket overarm. I can't throw properly. And as you know, the grenade action, you pick... So the grenade action with your right hand in an overarm loop, send the grenade not only up but forward. Now, I sent it up but not forward. Well, as you appreciate, it'll fall back on you. Well, these grenades to begin with were dummies. But then we moved on to live grenades, and the sergeant used to go bananas. Obviously it didn't go straight up in the air, so we'd all have been killed, but it went perilously close, and we all had to dash back and hide. So it was, grenades were the height of my horror. I mean, it's quite clear I wasn't going to be a firearm specialist.
What about the Sten, because that's even worse.
Oh, the Sten gun. Well, do I mean, when I said...
Sterling.
We had the Bren gun, but that's not the same as the Sten, is it? I don't think we used the Sten gun.
Sten goes the submachine gun.
Yes.
The Bren's the light machine.
Well, I don't think we got further than the Bren. Maybe that I didn't get further than the Bren. They thought there's no point. I blank that one out if I did.